Hello, hello. This is Allie Decker, and you're listening to the Long Game Podcast. Today, I chat with Brian Sparanello. Brian is a freelance copywriter who's generated more than $100 million in sales for health and fitness brands. He's been writing sales copy for over 10 years, and before he moved into full-time freelancing, Brian was the head of global e-commerce marketing for the NHL. Brian also runs Freelance Like a Pro, a blog dedicated to helping fellow freelance writers better generate referrals, and manage retainers. In this episode, Brian and I talk about his framework for deciding to go full-time as a freelancer, his barbell strategy for balancing client work, and much, much more. Without further ado, here's Brian Sparanello. Excited about today's episode. I'd love to start with just a quick intro and telling the folks who are listening a little bit more about what you do day to day.
Sure. Yeah. I kind of have two different sides to my life and my business. The biggest one in terms of where I make most of my money right now is as a freelance copywriter. So I work with a lot of direct-to-consumer, direct marketing, health and fitness brands. And I write everything from ad copy to sales letters to video scripts to basically anything that's getting the customer to make a purchase and take action. That's my wheelhouse. So that takes up most of my time, and that's where I make most of my money. But I also have a website that I've started called freelancelikeapro.com, where I've been freelancing for almost 10 years now, so I've learned a thing or two along the way. I've made plenty of mistakes along the way too, and so now I am trying to sort of share those lessons, share some of my experience, and help the next wave of freelancers hopefully avoid a lot of the pitfalls that I fell into, and help them sort of shortcut their success, see more money faster, less time, less stress. So I spend probably one day a week on everything it takes to manage that site.
Awesome. Well, I want to dig more into Freelance Like a Pro. I wrote down FLAP on my notes. Didn't realize that.
Yes.
I want to dig into that more in a little bit, but I'm a former freelance writer, so I want to spend some time talking about what you do as a writer, what kind of work that you do. Maybe tell us a little bit more about your favorite types of projects.
So the way I look at my business is, There's a concept in like finance and like stock trading. They call it the barbell approach, where either your investments are in extremely conservative buckets that you may not make money, but you're not going to lose money. Mm-hmm. And then some of your, so like 90% of your investments would be in sort of conservative bonds, et cetera, not going to lose money even if you don't make a ton. And then you take the other 10% and you go all the way to the other end of the spectrum and go super risky but super high return. And if one of those investments happens to take off, then that more than pays for all the losses you accrue along the way in that high risk category. So I take a similar approach with the way I structure my freelance business. And I try to spend about half of my time on stable, constant retainer work, because that brings in guaranteed income every single month. And that takes away the stress of like, can I pay rent? Can I afford groceries? Having that nice baseline of a considerable amount of money that allows me to live a good lifestyle, more or less on autopilot, right, is good. But at the same time, retainers are great in the sense that it provides stability and it provides recurring income, but they're also, they provide you with a floor, but that floor can also be a ceiling. So because you can't really grow. Part of the deal with a retainer is like the client is sort of booking you at that rate ongoing. So if you were to sign a retainer and then turn around 2 months later and say, hey, I'm raising my rates, like that would probably turn them off a little bit. So the retainer time is my stability time. And then I use the other half of my time in my growth projects. So those are things where I would either just charge a high initial rate or maybe get some sort of stake in the upside, royalties, performance bonuses. And because I have the stability on the retainer side of the business, it allows me to go sort of take bigger risks, throw more Hail Mary passes, because if they don't pan out, it's not like, you know, it's not like I need that sales letter to convert and earn me a commission, or I'm not paying rent. You know, I'm happy to take some more chances on that side to get some of that bigger return ultimately in the long term.
So the barbell, it's funny that you mentioned that, because we have a similar strategy we use for content strategy through Omniscient. So it's the same kind of approach to like the high risk, high reward, low risk kind of consistency. In terms of how you spend your time, what would you say your ratio is from the more consistent projects to the riskier projects?
Usually it's about 50-50. So I spend about half of my, so I spend about 4 days a week on my freelance copywriting. So two of those days would be retainers, and then two of those days would be larger projects, performance bonuses, et cetera. And then the last day of the week is for Freelance Like a Pro. So that's typically the way my week breaks out. And that's not all happening in a single day, right? So if it's not like Monday is one client, Tuesday is another client, yeah. You know? So even though it's sort of, it breaks out into those buckets, I'll be doing work for a couple different projects all in the same day. I just find it's too difficult. Although I know some people who like to sort of have themes for each day of the week and do the same thing. You know, every Monday is their strategy day and every Tuesday is their interview day. My clients have enough dynamic projects and enough ongoing deadlines that just wouldn't work for me. If I only did work for a certain client on Monday, they would need other things. They would need revisions. They would need feedback. So I just haven't been able to, for me, for my business and the clients that I serve, it's just not practical to take that approach. But again, if you can make it work, that sounds amazing. Yeah. If you can pull it off
too. And it there's just so many emails flying around and I'm like, crap, I wanted to start this day on something and now it's become a whole other thing. But it's nice to know you could at least like bucket like where your brain is that day. So there's not too much context switching.
Yeah. And I do try to block off the morning. So like the first 3 to 4 hours of my day are I'm pretty good about like not checking email, not going on social, really protecting those first 3 to 4 hours, getting all my writing done in that time. And then the rest of the day is a little bit more free flowing. If I need to edit something, if I need to take a call, if I need to answer emails, whatever it is. But you know, I find that for me, as long as I'm getting the 3 to 4 hours of like deep heads down writing every day, I can fit the rest of the stuff I have to do around that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say I've talked to a couple of people about this and really it's about 4 good hours of like heads down focused work, especially from like a creative perspective anymore. And I totally see diminishing returns. So I hear you on that.
It's not just you. I feel like Cal Newport has talked about that. Stephen King has talked about that. Like any creative, any writer, at least that I've heard of, has that 3 to 4 hour limit. And then there is just a huge drop off in their ability to create new things. Right? And that's, so for me, that's where I try to structure. Okay, I know I have to do revisions. To me, it's easier to edit something that's already on the page and that I've gotten feedback than it is to create something brand new from scratch. Right. So I'll schedule edits and stuff later in the day.
Yeah, I'm the same way. So I want to hear more about I know you worked full time before. I want to hear more about those roles and how you've transitioned into the specific industries you're in, because I believe health and fitness is really where you live. I'd love to hear about your experience and like the things you're passionate about that have kind of led to those niches.
Sure. So I got into freelancing in 2012. So it's been 10 years for me at this point. And I am a fairly risk averse person. So I kept my day job for half a decade before I quit to freelance full time. So I spent 5 years getting up at 5 a.m, doing client work before I went into the office, coming home from work and taking care of projects in the evening, ducking out on a lunch break and taking calls. And like, so when I try to make sure that I bring that up, because a lot of people will look and see where I am today, a full decade into my career, and they'll feel bad about the fact that they're not at that place when they've only been freelancing for a year or 2 years. And you know, if you look at what I was doing in my first and second year, many of the people who are feeling bad and comparing themselves to where I am today, they're doing better than I was in my first and second year. Yeah. So if only I could somehow like you know, become the Benjamin Button and turn the clock back on myself and let them compare themselves to the me of you know, 2013, 2014, yeah. It would help. I would think it'd help take away a lot of their sort of feelings of whether it's self-doubt or sort of comparisonitis. So I was working full time at in marketing and in consulting for a large government contractor who had a division that was effectively its own advertising agency. Okay. So we were listed on like the PR Week agency rankings and stuff. So it was really like a marketing firm nested inside a larger government contractor. I did that for a couple years. That's where I was when I started freelancing on the side. Then a friend of mine who I played hockey with in college was working at the National Hockey League. And at the NHL, whenever there's an open job, they'll email all the employees and say, hey, we're hiring for this role. So he got an email that he thought would be appropriate for me. Mm-hmm. So eventually I got what was probably my dream job. If I'm going to be an employee working and running the e-commerce marketing at the National Hockey League as a former hockey player, was a dream come true. So, you know, that's the, you know, pretty much being my own boss is the only thing that I could think of that would have pulled me away from that, from being in that role. But eventually I got to the point where I felt like I was ready to make that move and go work for myself full time. But again, it was 5 years into freelancing. And I actually had a tripod strategy for deciding when it was time to make that leap. The first leg of the tripod was having 6 months of savings in the bank. And that was savings calculated based on what I would need as a freelancer, right? So in the US, health insurance costs go way up. If I'm gonna go to a co-working space, other business expenses. So before I even left, I projected and figured out what those costs would be and made sure I had 6 months at that runway rate in the bank. And that's the first thing. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, my 6 months, that would take forever. But to me, that's actually a good thing, because if you're not making enough money on the side that you can't relatively quickly save up 6 months of expenses, right, how do you expect to pay your bills?
Right.
With, you know what I mean? So to me, the ability to save 6 months of your living expenses in a relatively short time frame shows that you're making enough money that it will then be sustainable for you when you leave your full-time job.
Yep.
So that was one piece. The other piece was having two, maybe three, like warm leads in my pipeline that I was confident when I left my job would have at least some decent chance of closing.
Okay.
And then the third thing was what I thought was actually the most creative thing that I did was at the NHL, we got summer Fridays. Mm-hmm. So I saved up all my vacation days and I told my boss, hey, I don't have any travel plans. So I'm actually just going to take off Tuesdays and Thursdays every week this summer. Plus we had a half day on Friday. So that gave me half of my week free. And then I signed a client on retainer while I was taking that time off to make sure. So I got to basically test drive what it would be like to be working for myself for entire days at a time during that period. And I got to sign a client on retainer that I knew would likely be there when I left my job. And I could make sure that that was all working for 6 weeks before I ran out of vacation time. So once all those things were in place, then I could leave, and I left my job with one retainer client signed in the bank, already paying me, other potential clients in the pipeline, and 6 months of expenses to fall back on, so that, you know, if I lost my retainer client, well, I could probably replace them with somebody else from the roster, and I could fall back on my savings. Or if none of those new leads panned out, I still had that one client on retainer that would at least cover most of my bills, and I still had the savings. Right. So between all three of those things, I felt like I really had that stability, yeah, where almost no matter what happened, I was going to be okay.
Yeah.
And that allowed me to really, I'm proud of the fact that every year since then, my income has grown, and I feel like it's because I gave myself that solid foundation, and I didn't just jump into it. And like, I know that, you know, there's that gif where the guy's just like throwing papers all over the place and he's like quitting in like a firestorm.
Right.
And then, you know, cause once you start scrambling, you know, you get into that feast or famine cycle and it's really hard to break out of. So
yeah,
for me,
your creativity and your ability to work, and it's just, it's very tough to get out of. It's interesting that you had multiple bases covered. And I want to lean in a little bit to that third element that you shared, because, you know, there's a lot of conversation around the financial preparation for freelancing, having a backup plan, having an emergency savings fund, all that stuff. But I don't think a lot of people talk about the physical and like emotional and environmental changes that take place when you don't have the structure that you're used to with a full-time job. So even if you don't like your full-time job, there are like psychological structures in place to help you get shit done. And I think a lot of people, they're like, I have 6 months of savings. Like, I have some referrals, I'm ready to go. And they sit down at their desk on day one, they're like, what do I do? So I want to learn more about like those Tuesdays and Thursdays and Fridays. Like, were there any shocks to your system? Were there things that you're glad you learned ahead of time when you went full time that you knew that you were ready for?
That's a great question. I don't think that I had any real shocks to the system, but I guess what's comforting is that if in a universe where there would have been a shock,
yeah,
I would have had that experience in a sort of safer, more constrained environment.
Right.
Again, I think the fact that I had been freelancing for 5 years up to that point was part of the reason that I didn't run into anything sort of out of the ordinary or unexpected at that point.
Right.
But that's not to say it couldn't have happened, right? Just the fact that it didn't happen doesn't mean that there wasn't the potential. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just because you're sort of cautious and you put a plan in place to cover a worst case scenario, it doesn't mean that that's wasted if the worst case scenario doesn't happen to occur, because, you know, that's just a coin flip. And, you know, eventually you're going to that worst case scenario will come to fruition. So having that discipline to always be trying to protect your risk and your downside, I think is an important thing to get comfortable with.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I'm definitely more of a risk averse person as well, so I can relate to that. What other structures have you built for yourself in your day to day? I know you said you try to have certain tasks that you spend each day, but as someone who's been doing this for so long, like non-financial things you've put into place to help that growth, help that consistency and discipline, what are some of those?
I schedule my entire life in my calendar. So when I'm in bed, when I'm having dinner, when I'm having lunch, when I'm answering emails, when I'm going to the gym. So, you know, for me, I used to have a to-do list, and the issue I have with a to-do list is there's no concept of how long each entry on a to-do list is going to take. So like, write my book and take out the garbage are both the same quote unquote size on a to-do list, but writing a book is a massively different task than taking out the garbage. So for me, being forced to not just say, hey, I have to get this done, but how much time is this going to take? And how is that going to impact the other things that I have to do? The structure of putting it all in a calendar, at least somewhat estimating the time requirement, for me, allows me to note and notice, hey, I may have overscheduled myself here because I probably need 3 hours for this. I probably also need 3 hours for this. Well, that's 6 hours and I only have two in this block. So I got to move something around. Otherwise I'm going to get to the end of that day and be like, oh my God, there's so many things that I didn't finish that I needed to finish. And I could have at least caught it ahead of time and tried to correct course. That, you know, again, thanks to that discipline of putting everything in my calendar. And it doesn't work for everybody. It's a little bit, it can be over the top, right? My fiance she sees my calendar and she's like, I get anxiety just looking at that from across the room. So, you know, again, to each their own, but for me at least, I find it helpful because it forces me to think about not just what I have to do, but how long it's going to take, and try to get to that second layer of planning to make sure I really have allowed enough time for everything.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I do a lot of that too. And I think over time, like, it helps you learn truly how long it takes to do certain tasks. Cause sometimes I get so honed in on just getting something done, I don't realize how long it takes. And the next time it comes around, it's just like, well, whenever I can fit it in. And then it just feels like chaos. So I love to be better at that. And I think a lot of folks listening probably agree, especially if you're doing that consistent work like freelancing. I know you work on a lot of similar projects across clients, so I'm sure you can kind of bucket that stuff easier.
And it's also important for knowing how much to charge, and you know, because if this is, I don't, do you watch Shark Tank at all?
Yeah.
So you remember, like, especially in the earlier seasons, these business owners would show up and they'd be like, oh, so what does it cost to make your thing? And they would just like go blank. Like they didn't even know what the cost of goods were to manufacture their product. And they would just get torn to shreds. Right. Do you remember those?
Yeah. That was really painful. Watch.
So I look at freelancers who don't know how much and where their time goes in somewhat of a similar manner, because as a freelancer, your time is your biggest cost.
Right.
So if you don't know roughly how long it takes you to do certain things, if you're not keeping at least some level of insight on your time and keeping an eye on that, that's just that there, to me, there's no difference between that and a business owner who makes a physical product and doesn't know what the cost of their goods are, because the cost, your time is your biggest cost. So if you don't know what that cost is, how are you going to properly charge to make sure that you get the margin and the return you need for the hours you're spending? Like, so to me, that's, again, and blocking out time in your calendar, especially if you go back. So like, you know, you block out 2 hours and something takes you 3 hours. If you go and you update that in your calendar, that can then become your sort of running record of how much time things actually took. You don't need a time tracking device. You don't need to use, you know, Toggle or whatever. I personally have a time tracker I really like, but you don't need that, right? It can be as simple as putting things in your calendar and then just making sure the calendar reflects what you actually did, and at the end of the week, just going and checking. Like, it can be that easy. You don't need all this fancy software if you don't want to.
Yeah, and at least can get you in the habit of paying attention to time. Because I know a lot of people aren't really in that element when it comes to getting things done and getting projects done. I want to talk a little bit about retainers. I know you mentioned it earlier. You have some information on your blog about the landlord retainer. So I'd love to hear, I guess, a multifaceted question of when you introduce that model into your business, how you decide when to make a project into a retainer project, and then tell us more about the landlord retainer.
Sure. So in terms of when I decide a client is a fit for a retainer, there's two factors. The best case, if you can get this, is a fixed set of deliverables every month for a fixed amount of money. So 5 emails or 10 blog posts or, you know, whatever that is, because then your time doesn't even factor in at all. The faster you get at producing those deliverables with high quality, the higher your effective hourly rate is for that project. But the challenge that I find is it's rare for me, at least, to encounter a client that needs that has a big enough budget and a big enough business where they can afford to spend a good chunk of money on a retainer that's just for like a smaller piece of their business, like just some emails or just some articles.
Right.
For me, it's more common that the companies that I find that are most open and receptive to a retainer are the ones where they've got a lot of different needs for copy, and they don't have the budget or the bandwidth to have a specialist on each and every project. Right. They need one person who's on the team, and they can just say, our copy, whatever we need, it's covered. We got our go-to person, and you know, we're going to assign them whatever projects are coming up on an ongoing basis. And you know, and that also ensures that there's sort of consistency between the ad copy and the page copy and the email copy, and that, you know, if one person is overseeing all of that, then it adds that congruence across the whole campaign. Mm-hmm. So the one downside or the challenge of that is then the only real constraint that you can put on the client in terms of like setting expectations is based on your time.
Yeah.
So it does become a sort of time for money thing, which is not great.
Yeah.
But the way I personally handle that is in my agreement, it will say the client has access to me not to exceed certain number of hours a month.
Gotcha.
Unless we agree in advance. So that means whether I work 0 hours or whatever, you know, the full amount, I still get the full retainer, right? So it's not to go over this amount, but there's no minimum. So it's not like if I don't work this time, I don't get paid.
Gotcha.
And that last piece of unless we agree in advance is important, because then in a separate conversation, I will tell the client, listen, this is just a guideline. If you have a big launch, if you have something going on, I will always, quote, agree in advance to make sure you get the deliverables and the assets you need.
Yeah.
As long as you're reasonable and as long as this is not an ongoing thing. If it's once in a while, we're both in this for a long-term mutually beneficial relationship. I'm not going to nickel and dime you that, you know, that yeah. when you're a millisecond over that, I'm not going to stop working. I'm going to make sure that you're happy. But it does give me the recourse where 2 months, 3 months in a row, it's always over. Then I can stop and have a conversation and say, hey, either we need to figure out who else on the team can handle some of these tasks so that I can work back under the original sort of scope of work that we agreed on, or we can consider increasing the retainer to increase my bandwidth and make sure that I'm covering everything you need. And that gives the client a choice. So it's not like you're painting them into a corner and saying, either you raise my rates or I'm leaving, right? You know, you're being flexible and saying, if you want to keep the budget where it is, fine, then we need to find someone else on the team who can take over some of the work. Or if increasing the budget is what you'd prefer and you'd rather have more of my time, then we can do that too. And I find that clients like having that, because then they feel like they're in control and that they're making a choice versus being painted into a corner where they have, basically it's either like do what I say or lose my services.
Right.
So that's how I look at like, when is somebody a fit for a retainer? I don't know if you have any follow-ups there, and then we can.
I can take that approach for sure.
Awesome. So when it comes to so you asked about the landlord retainer, yeah. and was that the next question?
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that.
Sure. So the way I came up with it was I realized after I had a client on retainer who didn't pay their last bill, that the end of a retainer is the point where a freelancer has the least leverage. Mm-hmm. Because during the retainer, if the client wants your services, then especially if you're billing in advance, like if they don't pay their bill, then you stop working. And they want to keep working, like they need your help. They will definitely prioritize paying that invoice to make sure that they keep getting your help.
Right.
But if they're like, we don't need your help anymore, and you know, you're at the end of the month, even if you have the best cancellation policy in the world, A, you're probably not going to make enough. Like a lawsuit is probably not going to be lucrative after you factor in what it's going to cost you. And B, if the client happens to be bankrupt, you could take them to court and win and still get $0 because there's no dollars left.
Mm-hmm.
So for all those reasons, even if you're billing your client a month in advance, you still wind up with that risk where at the end of the month or the first of the month, the client has not yet paid. And so even though you stop working, so you're not going to lose, right? You're not going to work a whole month, then bill the client and wind up not getting paid. So you've just worked a whole month and not gotten the money, right? So you're out, you lose your time and you lose your money if you try to bill after the work is complete. If you bill up front, at least you can stop working and not lose the time. But if you're counting on that invoice coming in to pay your rent, to, you know, put food on the table, it can still be really stressful if that payment doesn't come in. So even though you don't lose your time, you still need that cash flow, especially if you've turned down other projects in order to clear space for this retainer client.
Yep.
If all of a sudden they disappear, it's not enough to just not lose your time. You need to be compensated for that final month of the retainer, which, again, most agreements will have some sort of like 30-day cancellation policy where the client is responsible for paying that final month. So I realized that I don't want to call them shady landlords in New York City, but just New York City landlords in general are notorious for basically asking for, you know, your firstborn child when you try to rent an apartment. It's, you know, you need a background check, a deposit, the first month's rent. And most importantly, the idea that I took from them and why this is called the landlord retainer is they ask for the last month's rent up front.
Yep.
Because if a tenant breaks the lease and leaves, they've got that last month in the bank already. So it doesn't matter that the tenant is gone. They've already been paid for that month. And they can go find a new tenant and their cash flow is fine. So with the landlord retainer, you do the same thing. At the beginning of the retainer, the client pays a deposit for the final month up front. So that way, whenever the retainer is over, even if they ghost, even if they go bankrupt, that last month is in your account already. And then you have all of the leverage. So So it, to me, it's like, it's so, once I, as soon as I explain it to people, they're like, oh my God, that is so obvious. How did I never think of that before? But it can solve so many problems.
Yeah. And in the scheme of things, like, it not only gives you peace of mind, but it's not that much to ask, you know. It's like, well, we're going to work together. Like, this is just 1 month in advance.
Yeah.
Have you had any pushback on that?
Nope, never. So I, the way I, the, if we want to get a little bit more in the details, I will bill them for 3 months of the retainer up front.
Uh-huh.
So it's the remainder of the current month, right? So if we want to start working right now, they pay me from now to the end of the month. They also pay for the entire next month in advance, mm-hmm. right? So that I can start billing them a month ahead of time. And they pay for the final month of the retainer. So it's 3 months with 1 month prorated based on whatever is remaining in this current month.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, it's a decent amount of money. But at the same time, what I tell the client is that is what I need to now. I immediately will block off my calendar and make sure that from now all the way through the next 3 months, there is time for you. And that's part of what you are purchasing with that down payment.
Right.
Is I am now passing on other opportunities if I need to make sure that you've got my time.
Mm-hmm.
And that always seems to go over well. The one caution I do have to share with this model is you're going to get a big payment at the beginning of the retainer, and you need to be careful that you are committed then to work that final month without sending another invoice, right? So they're paying in advance, but that means you have to work that final month and you don't get to send another invoice. So if you go and you know, spend that money on, I don't know, you go buy some jewelry or you know, you put it in crypto and you lose it all, or you triple your money, whatever it is, you know, you need to be careful and you need to set that money aside and basically pretend like you didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
So that way, at the end of the retainer, you know, if you want, you leave that money in your business account as if it's never there. Then when the client ends the retainer, instead of getting their invoice, you take the money from your business account and you pay yourself personally that amount from the retainer at that point in time. And it's sort of like, again, it's like that money didn't really exist until the end of the retainer, and then you transfer it and it becomes part of your cash flow. And it makes up for the fact that you didn't send that final retainer invoice.
Yeah.
Again, because they paid up front.
Yeah. So it's a matter of discipline and just shifting your mindset, especially if you're used to those end of month invoices. I can see that being a challenge.
Yes.
You know, you said something about like explaining to the client, you know, this is the time that's dedicated to you. This is the time I have set aside. And I was reading a lot on your blog about the trick you use to get referrals and how part of that selling point is explaining how doing that saves even more time dedicated to clients. So I'd love for you to explain that part. I know it's a huge value prop for your website and Freelance Like a Pro. I myself was incredibly impressed by it. I've never thought about it before. How did that come about and what does that look like in practice?
Thank you. I appreciate that. So I guess the long and the short of it is at one point when I was freelancing on the side for my day job, I decided to basically go all in with one retainer client and make them an exclusive, which was great while they were paying me. But of course, as soon as it was over,
right.
I was now in the famine part of the feast or famine cycle, where I had not been doing any lead gen. I had not been bringing any new prospects in the door. So now I had to start from nothing. And that was unpleasant. So I started to think about, and this is something that I do a lot, is whenever I run into a challenge, I always think, okay, how do I make sure that this doesn't happen again? Right? It may suck in that moment, but it would suck a lot more if that problem continued to happen. So while I was freelancing on the side, I got to this point where I just didn't have the time to both service clients and do the lead gen, bring new people in the door. So I was essentially forced into that feast or famine mode, because on top of my day job, there just weren't enough hours in the day for me to continually do both. So I really had to come up, I was trying to think about, okay, what can I do to effectively bring new projects to me on autopilot?
Yep.
Because if I had like a magic tree that grew new clients, where, you know, every time one of my clients left, right, that tree would then bring me another client.
Yep.
And as crazy as that sounds, the method I came up with kind of does that. So the so I figured that there had to be a way to make this happen with referrals, right? Because if you can have your current clients bring you your next clients, that creates that infinite cycle where every time one project ends, that client refers you to another client and you get another project without having to go chase them down, without having to go post on jobs boards and all that other stuff. So the challenge is, how do you incentivize, how do you make your current clients want to bring you your next clients? And I think that's where, after banging my head against the wall a whole bunch and trying a lot of things that failed, I feel like I finally cracked the code. Because most people will say, like, they'll try a, you know, to use a referral fee, right? So they'll try to sort of bribe their way into referrals. But if you're talking about a multi-million dollar company, 10% or 20% of your fees is nothing. It doesn't even matter for them. Yeah. And now you're trying to make this a transactional thing with somebody who you've got a working relationship with, where it's like you're trying to buy them off. To me, it just felt really sort of gross, and I didn't like it. And it didn't work, right? It wasn't even like it was effective. Or the other thing is like, people will try to like play to their ego. Well, they'll say, you're going to look awesome to your network if you refer me, because I'm such a valuable resource. So if you refer me, then your connections are going to get awesome copy too, and they're going to thank you for it. And it's like, it's confusing. Again, it's not really that motivating.
Right.
And ultimately, I found that it didn't work. So what I found did work is, there is something that your clients are, they value it so much, they are willing to pay a lot of money for it. And that is your time and your energy and your effort and your services. So how can you give your client more of your time and more of your services in exchange for referrals?
Mm-hmm.
The way I do it is, I tell my clients that my goal is to spend as much time as possible serving them, serving their business. And I try to find anything that takes my time and attention away from them is something that I try to eliminate as much as possible. And that actually includes business development. Because if you think about it, every hour I spend out looking for a new client is an hour I am not spending on your project right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to do that. But the problem is, if I don't bring in new business, then I don't get clients, and then I go broke and I go hungry. So clearly I do need to bring in new business.
Yeah.
So that's why what I propose is, if you will give me two referrals at the end of this project together, I will not go and spend a bunch of time and being distracted and trying to chase down new business. I will focus more of my time, more of my energy, more of my effort on your project in the moment right now. I'll get it done faster. I'll be able to deliver a higher quality of work.
Yep.
And again, all I ask at the end is that you give me two referrals, so then I can keep my pipeline going, and I'll get my next, you know, my next project from that. And I have never had a client turn me down. I have had clients tell me, oh my God, I love that. Can I steal it? Right? So, and because it truly is a win-win-win, because what client doesn't want better service and more attention and a higher touch? Like, I can't, for the same amount of money, right? It doesn't cost them anything. All they have to do is send a few introduction emails. So to me, it was a no-brainer, and it really transformed my business, because that's really when I went from, you know, that feast or famine mode to having a steady stream of clients that allowed me to have that off-ramp to leave my job. That referral system, that I call it the 30-second referral method, because you can literally have that conversation in 30 seconds. Yep. and get the client to agree to referrals. So thank you.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, one of my questions I was going to ask you was, you know, percentage of time you spend on versus in your business. And it sounds like most of it's spent in your business doing the freelancing. So with this referral method in place, like, truly, how much time a week do you spend on business development and ops?
So all in, ops and everything, and I include time at events,
yeah,
and stuff like that as that, it'll be between 20 to 25% of my time going to admin, ops. And if you add up, you know, a whole day, you know, 3 days at a live event, that can be, I can, you know, because I consider that business development time, and I do sort of track that and bill myself, quote unquote, for that. So yeah, it's about 20 to 25%. And, you know, there is a point of diminishing returns, I guess, where, you know, every hour you spend working on a client project is an hour you're actually getting paid.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there are things that happen outside of that billable time that allow you to be more profitable, right? If you do something that raises your prestige or that raises your credibility, joining a mastermind and then attending those calls, that's time that I would sort of charge to that non-billable bucket. But joining those mastermind calls, doing the networking stuff there, has directly led me to significantly increase my rates. So, you know, you want to be strategic about, the goal is not to have zero, right? The goal is not zero non-billable time, because there are valuable things. The goal is really efficiency and making sure that if you're not doing client work, you're not just sort of wasting your time on low value, low return tasks, but every hour you spend away from a client is really, really high leverage, and it can turn into double or triple your rates or a new big client or something else where it justifies that sort of trade-off of non-billable time versus client work.
So tell me a little bit about what you do invest in to get better at your craft, to get better at your business. Like, what kind of stuff are you doing outside of client work?
So there's a big shelf of books behind me if you're watching the video. So reading is a big one. I also, like I mentioned, I joined a direct marketing mastermind in the beginning of 2020. So I attended the event, and then I joined the program at the event it was late February 2020. So there was like rumblings of COVID. And so it was one of the last events that happened, because within 2 weeks of getting home, everything was locked down, and you know, COVID was you know, here, if not to stay, certainly here for the foreseeable future. But even, you know, despite the whole, you know, the pandemic and everything, fortunately working with a lot of online retailers and, you know, the shift to e-commerce actually being a benefit to them, you know, since joining the mastermind, I've added almost $100,000 a year in annual income.
Wow.
Just in the 2 years. And again, I attribute a lot of that to the combination of skills and training that I was able to develop, and also access to the high caliber clients who were in that group, right, and then willing to invest in the people in that group because they knew they came with the skill set and the training that would justify the investment.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say the one thing, so this mastermind is called Copy Accelerator. It's a direct marketing and copywriting mastermind. And I will say the one thing that they did really well, but it's also really hard, is that there's almost two audiences. There's a group of business owners, and there's the copywriters, the freelancers.
Interesting.
And it's so I'm trying to imagine them, and how do you message to somebody who's a business owner and has one set of problems, and copywriters and freelancers who have a different set of problems, and yet build a group where they both come together?
Uh-huh.
And because to me, that was the key thing, is investing in a mastermind that's, I'm surrounded by other copywriters is great, but I wouldn't get business from that necessarily. It would only be through referrals from other people in the group. I would not have direct access to clients the way joining this mastermind. Part of the calculation was, not only will I improve my skills, but I will directly interact with many of my top tier clients.
Right.
And I immediately doubled my rates as soon as I joined, and I signed a client at those new rates within a few months. And so, you know, it almost immediately paid for itself, and it's continued to go up from there. So that to me was the biggest thing. And I was hesitant for a long time. I was like, I can learn it from books, I can learn it on my own. I guess maybe it's one of those things where, like, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. But I finally got to that level of humility or whatever, where I could say, hey, I could stand to learn from somebody else. I don't need to be doing this on my own. I can take feedback. I can say, I don't know everything. There are plenty of people with more experience, rather than me being off on an island by myself. Let me go. Let me partner with them. Let me learn from them. Let me truly become a student, and not, you know, this sort of, I think I know it all, but turns out I really didn't. So I'm very glad that I made that investment.
That's funny that you say that was kind of the moment, the light bulb moment, because I think a lot of people, like, that's exactly where I was before I invested in coaching. I thought it was like, oh, I don't need to pay for that. Like, it's not worth it. And I realized it was me. Like, it was almost like a pride factor.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for people like us who, I think, we're just natural, like, independent workers. Like, I've never been much of a team player. Like, I like doing a lot of my own stuff, not from, like, a I'm better than you perspective, but it's just where I thrive. And I think deep down, I am, like, course averse. And so it kept coming through that, like, moment of humility. But no, I think that the mix of that group sounds like something very unique. A lot of the communities I've seen for freelancers, they're good in a way because you meet a lot of people that are doing what you're doing. So it's community, but there's not a lot of exposure to different audiences and potential clients. So that seems really
It's, and that's a great, so A, the word you used, pride, right? So that to me was, that was the word that I was looking for. I had to swallow my pride and say, I don't know everything. And, you know, I'm a little on the older side now. I'm like 36. So in my mid 20s, there was no way I would have been open to that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it helps. And what I think about is, I don't know if hearing anybody speak, including myself talking to my past self, if anybody would be able to convince my past self that you know, stop that. Stop thinking that you can do this on your own. Really, you know, you would be making much faster progress if you swallowed your pride and you started to learn from other people.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know if it really is that once the student is ready, the teacher will appear, and it just takes time and maturity. And there is no way to convince somebody who is that stubborn 25-year-old, but maybe, possibly, cross your fingers, somebody who is in that place right now hears what I'm saying and reflects on it and it resonates, and maybe they do shift their perspective and they see that growth happen sooner for them.
Yeah.
That would be my hope. But, you know, again, it may only be, you know, the when you're ready and once you're mature enough, and it takes time.
Yeah.
But that was a great point.
That group.
So, you know, I had a client who I guess worked with one of the founders of the mastermind.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, so my client told me to get on this guy's list. His name's Justin Goff. He's one of the two founders of Copy Accelerator. I got on his email list. Then he started talking about the mastermind. And right before that event in February 2020, I lost a fairly big retainer client.
Yeah.
So I knew this event was going to be a honeypot of potential clients. So I went and I made the investment to attend the events. And the two guys who founded this mastermind, they're really smart. So, you know, they've sold over $1 billion combined in total products. So
that's awesome.
They allow you to, when you buy a ticket, it's basically like you test drive the mastermind for a month or however many weeks leading up to the event as part of the ticket. So you get to be in the group, you get to experience everything. And as I got that level of interaction, I was like, wow, this is really, really valuable, really helpful. And it's what started making me consider investing in the training, investing in the program at the event. It's the most amount of money I've ever spent on anything in my entire life. But they gradualized me, right? That's a copywriting concept is, you know, you start with a small number and then you slowly raise it. So it's like, imagine making $100,000, or even $100,000 a month in extra income, right? And because you start with a small number and you make it a little bit bigger every time, when you get to that big number, people tend to believe it more. Similarly, they got me in with the ticket. I got to experience the event, and you know, they built trust with me, and I got to see that this was going to be a worthwhile thing. And so eventually I did, you know, pull the trigger and make that investment, and it certainly paid off.
That's awesome.
So that was how I found out about it. That was just through a client referred me to one of the founders, was on their email list, started getting emails. And the timing was right because I was looking to replace that big retainer that I had lost.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Just the timing of it all and how it worked out for you and right before COVID.
Yeah.
Sounds like it was
meant
to be. I always like to ask the people who come on with me, what are some of the contrarian opinions that you hold about freelancing?
Oh God. Okay.
go with whatever came to mind. There's no wrong answers.
So I don't think this is going to undermine the business model you guys have. So because you have an agency approach. So the one thing I want to make clear before I go into this is the key thing is knowing what type of business you want to have. And the reason I say that is, if you think about the promise of digital marketing, it was going to be the great equalizer, and it's undisputably the most scalable, least costly form of marketing there is. TV, you know, for the cost of one TV ad, you could build a massive email list and all sorts of Facebook ads. And so digital marketing is arguably the most scalable marketing channel or marketing engine in the world. And services are arguably the least scalable business model in the world. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you should be using the most scalable marketing engine to drive the least scalable business model in the world. So to me, those things don't add up, especially, and here's the key, is if you want to be a solo professional, if you want to build a team and you want to run an agency, then yes, you have a higher demand, a higher volume of leads you need, you have a bigger business to run. That's a different thing. But I see too many people who want that solo professional lifestyle where they're just an expert in their craft, they get paid a lot of money to come in and do what they do and then leave and move on to the next thing, and that's what they want from themselves. But then they get sort of pulled in to the allure of digital marketing and building an email list and all that stuff, and one of three things happens. A, it doesn't work, but there's no guarantee any marketing is going to work. So put that aside. B is it kind of works, mm-hmm. but they have to spend so much time putting out content, emailing their list, creating a lead magnet, running ads, all that. And so they wind up spending 50% or 80% of their time on that stuff, and it only brings them in a couple of clients. And that's sort of the newsflash, is if you're a solo professional, you only need a few clients a month at most to make a healthy income. So all of that, and back to the conversation of like, what's that balance of non-billable time? That is, to me, way too much, because all you need to, if you're going to get one or two clients a month, you could do that with a few direct outreach emails, paying for a high quality, jobs board where you know, like, it's not Fiverr or it's not Upwork, but it's like a high quality place where you can get legit leads. You can easily survive on a handful, not just survive, you can thrive on a handful of clients a month. So you do not need this massive infrastructure that costs you a ton in either time or money to sustain to only bring in a few clients a month. So if you want to be that solo professional, don't get distracted by that other stuff. Find the most direct ways to get those few clients and do that. For me, it's live events, it's some direct outreach. For the mastermind I'm in, there's a jobs board that's part of that, and it's referrals. And that's it. And I make a very nice living without all of that other stuff. Mm-hmm. And again, the reason this is such a problem to me is once you build that email list, and this is the third scenario, is it really takes off. Then you're like, wait, I spent all this time, all this energy building this massive marketing engine. I now have way more leads than I could possibly close. Mm-hmm. I'm leaving money on the table. So now I'm going to start an agency, even though I don't want to, even though it wasn't my vision. Then they get burnt out because they don't want to be a leader. They don't want to build a team. Like, that was not what they got into this to do. But the tail is wagging the dog. And at that point, they feel like, oh, I have to find some way to monetize this thing because they have that sunk cost.
Yeah.
But then you know, they build this agency, and a year later they're burnt out. They're making less money than they did before because now they have all this staff and all this overhead. Or the other thing they do is they build some shitty online course that nobody wants to buy. And so you're laughing, but it's a real thing.
Oh my gosh, courses and emails and newsletters all over the place.
From people who did not set out with that intention.
Right.
They did it by accident because they picked the wrong marketing strategy for their business model, and then after they made that big investment in their marketing engine and it started to work really well, instead of saying, wait a minute, this is not right for my business model and my vision for my life, they changed their business model and their vision for their life, and they go in this direction that they did not want to go in, and that's ultimately going to leave them unhappy and unfulfilled and probably unsuccessful because they're not that passionate about it.
Right.
So for me, if you start off with that intent of this is the business I want, and then I'm going to pick the marketing channels that are appropriate for that business, that to me is the most important thing. And that's why, again, so the contrarian thing is I don't think freelancers need to be worrying about having a website, digital marketing, building an email list. Yeah. I would say go to events, network, direct outreach, maybe join a mastermind, maybe get in a high quality jobs board, but direct contact, referrals, use the referral strategy I shared. Yeah. And that's more than enough.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I agree with that for sure. I think that that's something that a lot of people feel the obligation to do. And it becomes more of an obligation than just a true opportunity, especially when it kind of shifts in the middle and you're like, well, I have to do this. Like, look at all the stuff that's coming in. So I hear you and I've seen it a lot. I've heard about it a lot. So I think that's some really good advice. Before we close,
thank you.
I'd love to have you tell our listeners, you know, where they can find you, some of your resources online and any potential clients where they can find you too.
Sure. So I actually put together a special page just for listeners of this podcast. Mm-hmm. And we talked about the landlord retainer a little bit before. So if you go to freelancelikeapro.com/longgame, and that's all one word. So freelancelikeapro.com/longgame, you can grab the exact contract template that I use when I use the landlord retainer in my business. And that way you can literally copy and paste and in a matter of minutes start using the landlord retainer in your own company. And so you can get that, no strings attached. I'm not even going to ask for your email address because the way, you know, the way I see it is that I'm happy to invest in you first and to give you this resource from my library because I believe it's going to help me gain your trust.
Yeah.
And at that point, you're actually going to want to get on my email list rather than me kind of forcing you by like teasing you with this thing. I'm going to give you the guide again, no strings attached. Prove that my material can really help your business. And then my hope is that once you see that, you're actually going to want to join my email list to get even more of my resources and material. So again, that's freelancelikeapro.com/longgame. And Allie, thank you so much. This has been amazing.
Thank you for joining me today.